The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Anemia is presented by Dr. Cheryl Kowalski.
Good morning and welcome. And I'm so happy to be here today, and you guys are so tough to be here at 7 o'clock in the morning on the last day. And thank you to Susan and Kevin and the ACOI for giving me the privilege of talking to you this morning. We're going to start with anemia. I have a lot of slides, and it's going to be pretty much rapid fire. A lot of this stuff I had put in like an addendum at the end, but that wasn't working well, so I've incorporated it into the lecture, but it's for reference only, so we're going to probably skip over some of those slides so we can get to the meat of everything. So the first thing we need to do is define anemia. So most people think, oh, it's if you've got 10 or 11 grams of hemoglobin, that's okay. But really, the definition is around 13. So let's start out with the most common nutritional problem in the world, which is iron deficiency. And I would just like to say this little screen down front isn't on to our AV guys. So that would be helpful. The reason it's most common is you have to have so many things that work together. So you have to be able to have an active small bowel, you have to have acid available, and then you got to think about some of the things that inhibit the absorption of iron, and things like phytates, which is bran, and so people that are on a high bran diet might have some problem with inhibition of absorption. And then there's a lot of people who drink a lot of tea, and that can inhibit as well. So some other causes of iron deficiency, blood loss, as most of us think of, is probably the most common. Decreased intake, increased utilization, such as people especially that are on erythropoietin therapy, we may not think about that so much. Chronic hemolysis and then malabsorption. And always think about the gastrectomy patients and the weight loss bariatric type patients. So a lot of the manifestations of iron deficiency you can see, and probably the most common is that fatigue and irritability. When you think about iron deficiency, one of the things we're going to do is look at the CBC, and the MCV generally is going to be low, but not always. And you're going to also do a reticulocyte count. If it's corrected at greater than 2%, think about blood loss or hemolysis. If it's less than 2%, think about a hypoproliferative process, especially a deficiency. So when we think about microcytic anemia, you're going to obtain and interpret your iron studies, which sometimes can be a little bit difficult. Look at your serum iron, your total iron binding capacity. And then think about your ferritin, because an elevated ferritin can exist with an iron deficiency because of a coexistent inflammation. So sometimes those iron deficiencies or iron studies are a little bit harder to interpret. So when we look at the blood smear on these patients, you're going to have a variety of sizes and shapes. The technical words for sizes and shapes is anisocytosis and poikilocytosis, and you're going to have that central pallor. So first thing we're always going to do, don't just put your patients on iron. Look for the source of blood loss. And sometimes that can be really difficult to find. And then think about your patient who may be a regular blood donor. They may not have mentioned it to you, but talk to them about that. When you're going to replace iron, you're going to use ferrous sulfate, 325 milligrams. Now most of it is labeled 65 milligrams elemental iron. And at least twice a day, if not three times a day, as they can tolerate it, remember that it doesn't do any benefit to take all the pills at one time because the gut can only absorb so much at one time. If they don't respond to oral iron, then they may be a candidate for IV iron. Other microcytic anemias are your sideroblastic anemias. And so this is a really diverse group of anemias. And it usually is a defect in the incorporation of the iron into the heme molecule. And then if you look at your bone marrow, you can have the ring sideroblast, which you can see that accumulation of iron around the nucleus. So the classification is acquired idiopathic, and this is one of the subcategories of myelodysplastic syndrome. Then there's more reversible ones, such as patients who are alcoholics or INH, chloramphenicol medications, and then lead poisoning. So the treatment for sideroblastic is generally supportive. Sometimes pyridoxine may be of benefit. Sometimes it may be severe enough to require bone marrow transplant, especially myelodysplasia. And then erythropoietin treatment may be of benefit in some of these patients. We'll move on to another microcytic anemia called thalassemia, and this is probably the world's most common genetic disorder. We have two types. We have the beta thalassemia, and this is a decreased synthesis of a beta globulin chain, most usually caused by point mutations, and so there's a relative excess of alpha globulin chains, and you diagnose this with hemoglobin electrophoresis. Then there's the alpha thalassemia, and there's a decreased synthesis of alpha globulin chains, mostly caused by gene deletion, and it results in a relative excess of beta globulin chains, and this is diagnosed by an alpha thalassemia gene probe, not by hemoglobin electrophoresis. When you look at the blood smear on these patients, these are the ones that are going to have the target cells. Again, different shapes and sizes or increase of anisocytosis or poikilocytosis, and that's what gives you your increased RDW when you're looking at your red blood smear. The clinical classifications of beta thalassemia is the minor, which is generally not an issue. You may just see microcytosis. They're intermedia, which may sometimes start requiring transfusions, and then the major, which is transfusion dependent, and there's many, many different types of genotypes. So you're going to see in these patients, as I just said, the microcytosis and hyperchromia may have a mild anemia in the trait or the mild beta thalassemia. And again, a variety of different genotypes and presentations. And when you start developing the intermedia, then you start having the bone disease, iron overload from transfusions. You may have splenomegaly and pulmonary hypertension, which is generally what you oftentimes see in the beta thalassemia major. These are always transfusion dependent, and they have a very high hemoglobin F. So these are all the different problems that you can see with beta thalassemia, especially major. In this little girl, you can see the bone deformities that you can get from the problems of the thalassemia. In the alpha thalassemia, you have the silent carrier, which has three of the four alpha genes, and they're all functional. The next is the trait, where you have two of the four functional genes, and then hemoglobin H disease, where you have only one of the four. And these are starting to have a higher hemoglobin BARTS. And then the hemoglobin H disease, you have very ineffective erythrocytosis, iron overload from transfusions. And then the hydrops fetalis, where there's no functional alpha globulin genes. And that's, as we all know, routinely fatal. So when you talk about thalassemia trait, with two of the four genes present and functional, you may have a mild anemia, MCVs less than 80, Usually thalassemia will have the lowest MCV of any patients that you'll see unless you have a very profound iron deficiency. So when you see a really low MCV, MCV of less than 70, think thalassemia. So who are we going to screen? You want to screen patients that have a microcytic anemia that have no other reason to have this. And if you're working up the alpha thalassemia, you need to do an alpha thalassemia gene probe. But this is always a diagnosis of exclusion first. Rule out all your other things, and you always have to have a hemoglobin electrophoresis first to rule out a beta thalassemia. And then if everything else been ruled out, then go ahead and get the alpha thalassemia gene probe to make that diagnosis. And the reason we want to do it is we don't want, the biggest mistake can be, is treatment with iron without the benefit of iron studies. So you also want to know if your patients have this, because if they're going to be having children, then they want to know if that mate that they're going to have, the parent, the other parent also has it, to keep the problem from being worse and worse. So let's move on to the normochromic normocytic anemia. And this is anemia of chronic disease, as we all think about it, and it's hypoproliferative. So this is a really interesting anemia where there's decreased red cell survival. So usually red blood cells last about 120 days. In this case, they may only last 30 or 40 days. There's impaired EPO production, as well as response to erythropoietin, impaired mobilization of iron, and it's always an inflammatory response to an underlying disorder. So some of the things that can cause this that are non-hematologic are like chronic infections, an underlying malignancy, chronic inflammation, and trauma. So how you make diagnosis? Again, diagnosis of exclusion. Make sure you don't have any deficiencies. And remember, as the person gets older or the person has more medical problems, there can be more than one reason for a person to be anemic. So these patients will have a low serum iron despite increased iron stores in their bone marrow and their macrophages. So we can look at this cartoon here, and in the middle is normal absorption of iron. So you have normal production of hepcidin by your liver, and that's kind of like the gatekeeper for the ferroportin, those little blue nodules that are there. And as long as those are all working correctly, you have a normal amount of iron flowing into through your cells. But if you have anemia of chronic disease, some kind of chronic infection or chronic problem going on, the liver makes more hepcidin as an inflammatory type of reaction. And so it prevents that ferroportin from working as well as it should. And actually, some of the ferroportin actually gets all absorbed. And so there's less ability for the iron to enter into your system. As opposed to the right side of the slide, which is hemochromatosis, where there is reduced or no hepcidin production in the liver, and so the ferroportin just populates and allows lots of iron to come in. So the therapy is usually self-limiting. So always treat the underlying disorder, and you can correct any coexistent deficiencies. That you're always going to do to work this up. You're going to check your iron, B12, and folate levels. And then selected patients may benefit from erythropoietin, but I wouldn't decide that on your own. I'd have your patient see your local hematologist. Generally, insurance only covers renal failure and HIV infection for this, and so you don't want to get stuck with big charges for erythropoietin supplementation. Macrocytic anemia, we'll move on to the large cells. So there's abnormal nuclear maturation in red cell precursors. And most common things that cause this are B12 deficiency, folic acid deficiency are the ones we think of most commonly, but also chemotherapy, which we also think about. Myelodysplastic syndrome can cause this, as well as monoclonal protein, anything from just monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance all the way up to multiple myeloma. So to have good B12 absorption, you have to have a stomach that is producing acid, pepsin, parietal cells, an intrinsic factor, an active duodenum, and an active terminal ileum. So some causes, we think of dietary lack, but in our day and age with so many people on H2 blockers or PPIs, you're going to have a lack of acid. You're going to have, think about having a deficiency of intrinsic factor, especially in patients who have had gastrectomies or bariatric surgeries. Think about pernicious anemia. And then some associated autoimmune disorders can cause this as well. So other more less common causes of B12 deficiency are listed there, but I would bring to your attention to metformin, which is used so widely in the United States nowadays, as well as infections such as HIV and H. pylori. So here's just a list of some of the neurological problems that you can see with B12 deficiency. And the interesting thing is that sometimes the neuropsych symptoms can predate hematological changes. So the standard, even though your labs may say normal B12 is greater than 180 or greater than 220 or greater than 250, our neurology colleagues tell us that when that B12 level drops below 300, there's an increased risk of peripheral neuropathy. So my goal in treatment of patients is to try to keep that B12 at greater than 300. When you look at the blood smear, you can see that there's some large red blood cells there. That white blood cell, you can see, normally white blood cells should have 3 to 5 lobes. You can see that's hyperlobated, and there's usually 6 to 8 lobes in a B12 deficiency. It's usually about 10 to 12 microns apart, while a white blood cell is only about 6 microns apart. Across, which is the size of that small lymphocyte that you see there, and you can see that the red blood cells are much larger than that small lymphocyte. So when you're working a patient up for B12 deficiency, you can get methylmalonic acid and homocysteine levels. Those are usually going to be elevated. I don't think that those are necessary to make that diagnosis. But one of the things you might want to think about in a B12 deficiency is to rule out pernicious anemia with 2 simple tests, antiparietal cell antibody and anti-intrinsic factor antibody. The reason being is that if the person has pernicious anemia, they're going to need B12 supplementation indefinitely. While it was always thought you needed to replace that IM or sub-Q, most patients will respond to sublingual nowadays. And there's about a 20% increased risk of gastric carcinoma and development of gastric carcinoma in patients who have pernicious anemia. So if you've diagnosed a person with pernicious anemia and they come to you down the road saying, you know, I've been having some digestive problems, you're not going to put them on a trial of PPIs or whatever your favorite antacid is. You're going to be more prone to get them to your local gastroenterologist for that scope. So let's think about folate deficiency. Dietary is the most common. It's thought that without folate, you will develop a deficiency within 3 months. But folate is so ubiquitous in the things that we eat that that's pretty uncommon. But increased requirements and intestinal malabsorptions can certainly be an issue. And then drugs that interfere with folate metabolism. So there's 2 different tests, the serum folate and the RBC folate. Many of your hospital labs have just gone to serum folate, and that's fine. Just get your patients to have it fasting, and you'll have your most accurate one. I think with this and B12 deficiency, accuracy is not the issue. It's replacing, even if they're borderline, because you're not going to overdose these patients if you replace them a little bit. And they will feel a lot better. So treatment usually is 1 milligram a day. That's by prescription. They can be adequately replaced with over-the-counter supplements, which comes in 400 and 800 micrograms, and that's fine. Just recheck your levels down the road, again fasting, to make sure that they are being replaced. So think about prophylactic treatment, especially pregnancy, we all know, but also hemolysis and dialysis. So moving over to hemolytic anemia, this is the premature destruction of red blood cells, and it can be one of 2 different mechanisms. Extravascular, hemolysis, which is where the red blood cells are prematurely removed from the circulation by the liver or the spleen, and then intravascular hemolysis, where the red blood cells are lysed in the circulation. And there's two main causes of intrinsic red blood cell defects, which is inherited, and then acquired, which is extra corpuscle causes. So the hereditary ones are listed here. We got to think about red blood cell enzyme defects, red blood cell membrane defects, the hemoglobinopathies, and thalassemias. And the acquired, we think of immune types, splenomegaly, microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, PNH, and a direct toxic effects from things like malaria, and then the less common sparse cell anemia. So the diagnosis of hemolytic anemia is your corrected retic count is greater than 2%. You usually have an elevated indirect bilirubin, elevated LDH. Your haptoglobin will be low or absent. And then think about urine hemosiderin and hemoglobin. So the urine hemosiderin is present in intravascular hemolysis only. And then the hemoglobin will be present only in intravascular hemolysis when it's severe. So you do your dipstick and it says you have blood, but when they look at it under the microscope, you don't see any red blood cells. So hemolytic anemia is the cells just get smaller and smaller and smaller as pieces are taken out of the red blood cells, and again, a variety of shapes and sizes. So diagnosis, first test we always think about is the direct antiglobulin test or the Coombs test. And this is useful in diagnosing immune hemolytic anemia, where the antibody is coating the patient's red blood cells. And so it's done by mixing the red blood cells with anti-human globulin, which contains IgG and C3. And the test is positive if agglutination occurs. While the indirect diagnosis, the antibodies present in the serum. So this little cartoon here at the top shows the direct antiglobulin test. So here we have the patient's red blood cells, and they have antibody covering them. And then they're washed, and then they're mixed with a reagent. And if there's agglutination, then we know that the patient has those antibodies. The indirect, we have the patient's serum, and they have the little antibodies we suspect are there floating in the serum, and we mix them with donor red blood cells or reagent erythrocytes that have this antibody on them, or antigen, and we assume that they'll connect if they're there, and then put in the reagent, and if there's agglutination, then you know that the patient has antibodies in their serum. So immune hemolytic anemia is usually idiopathic, and it's induced by binding of antibody or complement to the red blood cell. It's caused by autoantibody directed at patients against the patient's red blood cells, or acquired alloantibody directed against transfused red blood cells. And Coombs is the only test that provides definitive evidence of immune hemolysis. So one type is warm antibody autoimmune hemolytic anemia, and those antibodies react at 37 C degrees. IgG is usually present on the red blood surface, but they can also have C3. Most of them are idiopathic, and it can be a complication of underlying disease, such as listed here, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, collagen vascular diseases, ulcerative colitis, and congenital immunodeficiency. Treatment of the warm reactive autoimmune hemolytic anemia is still our standard prednisone at 1 mg/kg, and folic acid, and sometimes they'll need a splenectomy, but this is becoming less common as the patient as we have developed other medications that can be used, such as immune globulin and Rituxan. And these patients can sometimes have so many antibodies, you can't find donor red blood cells to transfuse to them that absolutely are a perfect match. And so we do what we call transfuse the least incompatible blood. So immune hemolytic anemia, continuing with cold antibodies. So this, again, can be caused from other diseases, not only idiopathic, but chronic lymphocytic leukemia, mycoplasma infection, which is one we think of frequently, and also infectious mononucleosis and paroxysmal cold hemoglobinuria. So the treatment, again, is avoid cold exposure, and these patients inevitably are going to be the patients that are out shoveling the snow with no gloves. Also keep them on folic acid, treat underlying disease if it's present. Immunosuppressive agents sometimes can help. In this case, the splenectomy is of little value. Sometimes rituximab is helpful, and sometimes plasmapheresis is helpful. So transfusions of packed red blood cells, always do compatibility testing at 37 degrees Celsius, because less than that, it'll agglutinate. And it's recommended, although there's been no efficacy in clinical trials, to transfuse them with warm blood or through a warmer. Paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, it's an acquired stem cell disorder in which the mutation of PIGA gene causes defective production of the GPI anchor protein. Interestingly, only a portion of the red blood cells are affected, and depending on the person, some are a few of your red blood cells, some are many. And so that makes the disease go from mild to severe. And also, your platelets and white blood cells can be affected as well. And so these red blood cells are more sensitive to complement-mediated hemolysis. So these presentations, they have the picture of hemolysis. It's been present for a long period of time. This is an intravascular hemolysis, and you can see that absent haptoglobin, increased LDH, and these will also have hemoglobinuria and hemosiderinuria. So this can be found in the setting of another bone marrow disorder, which is very interesting, aplastic anemia or refractory anemia, which MDS. And sometimes they're so subclinical that there's no hemolysis. And so these patients are diagnosed, you have to get a flow cytometry that specifically says that it's directed for this type of diagnosis. It's directed against the GPI anchor protein. So a regular, just routine flow cytometry is not of any benefit. So treatment can be as simple as folic acid and corticosteroids. Upon occasion, they might need transfusions or iron. We don't need to be careful about anticoagulation with warfarin. And then the more severe cases might be a candidate for Soliris, which is a relatively new medication out about 6 or 7 years. But treatment with that, if patient starts that, it's in the neighborhood of $100,000 a year. And some stem cell transplant is also sometimes a benefit. So non-immune hemolytic anemia. So these are inherited, and we think of hereditary spherocytosis, elliptocytosis, and stomatocytosis. And the most common one is the spherocytosis. So what happens is that there's a molecular defect in one or more of the proteins in the red blood cell cytoskeleton, and it causes the cell to contract. So instead of looking like a donut on edge, it looks like a sphere. And so it makes that more fragile and prone to hemolysis. So these can be anywhere from mild to severe. You can usually make the diagnosis on peripheral smear. You can sometimes use osmotic fragility test to make diagnosis. But many times, you just make the diagnosis by the family history and looking at the peripheral smear. So if you look at these will also have a low MCV. And you can see next to the white blood cell, these red blood cells are very small. You don't see that central, mild central pallor that you do in normal red blood cells, but more like spheres or balls. G6PD deficiency is the most common enzyme deficiency worldwide. And there's all different types of gene mutations, so they may be mild to more severe. And drugs associated, I put just a few here, but to think of Primaquine, Sulfadaptone, Nitrofurantoin. And if you see a question on your boards about fava beans, think G6PD deficiency. So the hemolysis is usually self-limiting, usually lasts 2 to 4 days. And infections, including and as well as diabetic ketoacidosis, can cause this. And diagnosis is made by obtaining G6PD level, but in the steady state, not during the acute crisis, because as those cells lyse, they'll release what little bit of G6PD that they have, and that your test may actually return as normal. So when you look at the blood smear, you can see these bite cells. And then those little dots up in the corner on those cells are the Heinz bodies, which is precipitated hemoglobin. Hemoglobinopathies is another form of anemia, sickle cell disease, where the bone marrow makes sickle-shaped red blood cells due to the qualitative defects of globulin chain synthesis. So these patients, to have the disease, have greater than 50% hemoglobin S. And again, remember, there's multiple genotypes and phenotypes. And also remember that sickle cell trait is not a disease. So look at this cartoon in the top. That's the normal compressibility of the red blood cells going through the capillaries. While the sickle cells, if you look at the cross-section, the sickled hemoglobin causes strands to keep the red blood cells from having that nice shape, and it doesn't allow them to slide through those capillaries very well. So we can think of a lot of the complications of sickle cell anemia, and I'm just going to remind you about the painful episode, which we always think about as being the most common, many others that are there. And so general medical care is what these patients need. Pain management, avoid meperidine with Demerol, which I'm not even sure is on pharmacy formularies anymore in hospitals. Some of these patients should be on hydroxyurea, especially if they're having regular hemolytic crises. We don't try to transfuse them to up to hemoglobins of 10, 11, 12. We just kind of keep them at their baseline, whether it be 5, 6, or 7. And some of these patients may be candidates for stem cell transplant. Aplastic anemia it can be seen in three different forms. It's just mainly bone marrow failure. It could just be pure red blood cell aplasia, or you could have thrombocytopenia or leukopenia with it as well. So there's many different types. Classification. Idiopathic is probably the most common, and then, of course, there's secondary ones. So this diagnosis is made by showing 4 to 5 cores of less than 30% cellularity, and we always get a flow cytometry and cytogenetics because that will help us determine if this is actually a rare form of myelodysplastic syndrome, which is hypocellular. So the picture on the left is normal bone marrow. You can see about half of your bone marrow in a normal person should be fat, and the rest is hematopoietic tissue. You can see on the one in the lower right that there's very little hematopoietic tissue, and most of it has been replaced by fat. So treatment for this is antithymocyte globulin and cyclosporin. And some of these patients may be transplant candidates as well.